conversation is in dialogue with some of the other learning that you've been doing. The topic, the way into this theme that I wanted to explore together today is a reflection on something that I see very much connected to broad issues of spiritual and emotional well-being in our culture today. So that's big. It's really, my starting point is really the problem of loneliness and the problem of narcissism. Okay, so I'm going to be provocative for a start. And say that I think that in American culture today, there's an epidemic of both loneliness and narcissism, and I think the two are very much interconnected. I think that the ways in which we are constantly receiving cultural messages about the need for self-sufficiency, for individuals being enough unto themselves, are deeply bound up, actually, with the ways in which so many of us, don't want to make assumptions here, but the way so many of us struggle with loneliness and sort of an attenuated sense of our connection to one another. And when I'm talking about connection to one another, I'm talking about that on a very practical level of lived experience, but I'm also talking about it in a broader theological context. And there are ways in which the sources that I want to look at together today, for me, reflect some very deep Torah that we are lucky to inherit, that offers a very, very different model for understanding what it means to live in relationship to each other and what it means to live in relationship to God. So that's the big frame. And just to get our juices going, I'm sorry, the pagination got a little bit messed up here, but so we're starting at the bottom of the page that has the title on it, Rejoicing in Being Apart, or in Hebrew, Sameach Lechavko. And I will say more about how I'm reading that as we get deeper into the session. But at the very bottom of that page, I wanted to actually just trigger the conversation with a brief passage from a book called Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, who some of you may be familiar with, who writes and teaches a lot about, among other things, about vulnerability. And so there's a passage in this book that really struck me as being a wonderful point of departure and wonderfully in dialogue with some of the Torah that I want to look at together today. So she writes the following. When I look at narcissism through the vulnerability lens, okay, so she's using her lens of thinking about vulnerability and looking at narcissism through that lens, I see the shame-based fear of being ordinary. I see the fear of never feeling extraordinary enough to be noticed, to be lovable, to belong, or to cultivate a sense of purpose. I can see exactly how and why more people are wrestling with how to believe they are enough. We're going to come back to that language in a little bit. Why more people are wrestling with how to believe they are enough. I see the cultural messaging everywhere that says that an ordinary life is a meaningless life. And I see how kids can absorb this messaging and develop a completely skewed ends of the world. I am only as good as the number of likes I get on Facebook or Instagram. How many people, by the way, you know, I like to think I'm beyond this at age 58, but how many people have posted something on Facebook and sort of obsessively gone back to check how many likes you've gotten? Yeah, okay. Right, I'm not proud. We are all vulnerable to the messaging that drives these behaviors. I know the yearning to believe that what I'm doing matters, and how easy it is to confuse that with the drive to be extraordinary. I know how seductive it is to use the celebrity culture yardstick to measure the smallness of our lives. And I also understand how grandiosity, entitlement, and admiration seeking feel like just the right balm to soothe the ache of being too ordinary and inadequate. Yes, these thoughts and behaviors ultimately cause more pain and lead to more disconnection, but when we're hurting and when love and belonging are hanging in the balance, we reach for what we think will offer us the most protection. Now, I don't want to stay here for too long because I really want to dig into the sources, but I just want to linger for a minute and hear, really, first, just does this resonate for people, what Brené Brown is describing here, and if so, how? Does it ring true? Does it? Yeah. And can you say your name?
My name is Arthur Waller. I find this doesn't resonate with me at all. To me, this is alien thinking. The fact that ordinary people think they're not important enough. That's the bulwark of our nation, is the middle class, the people who do the work every day.
Right.
And I think that the solid people in the middle, those people, have a good deal of respect for each other and themselves.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that she's got it at all. I think she's
in
elitist
some other
world.
Okay.
And I don't think she understands those people.
Okay, interesting.
Susan Cohen, I live in Brookline, work in Boston, and this does resonate with me, and my children are 20, 20, and 22, and my vicarious experience of living alongside them at these ages, mm-hmm. and these are children who've grown up on social media mm-hmm. from the get-go, so I sort of vicariously, this resonates with me as what I perceive to be my children's perhaps experience. And I'm not saying they have gotten sucked into this, but I fear they could.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in college, they're finding their way, but I think their early working career could be low. I mean, these are issues that I have concern as a mom for
right.
them.
Okay, thank you. So there may be a generational element here. There certainly are different cultural elements. I think that as we look at some of the sources, I see some of these things as very much culturally bound and some of them as very deeply human and actually fairly universal struggles. So, but we'll see where we land. Any other quick reactions to this opening? Yes.
Robbie Amfeld.
Yep.
Boston.
A little bit louder, I think, so people don't hear.
New Bedford, also a part of the community in New Bedford.
Yeah.
But in terms of the generational thing, I see people who are retiring, including myself having gone through that, identified so much with their work and professions that is what matters,
right?
And they don't feel that they matter mm-hmm. once they've given up career,
right?
And that's a big adaptation.
Yes. Thank you. That really is, I think, adds another important dimension generationally and really rings true for my own experience of my parents aging and their friends. And, really important, that question of how bound up our identity is with our work and how that relates to whether we feel we are enough and have done enough. And
Ira Stoll from Boston. I think this dichotomy she sets up between ordinariness and grandiosity seems a little bit potentially false, particularly in the Jewish context, where, like, if the Jews were at Sinai, where God's chosen people, were supposed to be a light unto the nations, like, her sort of defense of ordinariness seems almost like in danger of verging on settling for mediocrity, which
interesting.
I think, you know, rather than striving for excellence, which can be a positive thing rather than just a negative.
Great. Okay. There's a time. You're making me think of my mother used to say. I'm sorry. Hold on one second. My mother used to say, you know, the expression "Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good" is just an excuse for mediocrity. That's what, so you know, I'm hearing.
Can you just repeat what everyone says because we can't hear it.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah.
I don't understand a word. It's a far way of facing there. It's like very. It's really. It's not enjoyable.
Okay.
And I don't know what you're talking about. What subject? What book you're going to read from? Nothing.
Okay. Is that because are you having trouble hearing?
No, I have very good hearing.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's move into some of the texts and see if that helps you. Okay. Give me a flag if it doesn't. And I want to use this as a segue into the first text. Okay. So I want to turn to the Mishnah from Sanhedrin. And I want to actually relate this directly. You said your name was Ira? Yeah. Relate it directly to Ira's point, picking up on what Brené Brown has posed in terms of a dichotomy between ordinariness and extraordinariness. And I want to say that the Torah of this Mishnah from Sanhedrin, I think, presents a very powerful understanding of the human condition as essentially that we are each radically extraordinary as human beings. And so extraordinariness is utterly ordinary, right? But the thing we have in common as human beings, the thing we have in common is that each of us is utterly unique and therefore radically precious in the eyes of God, in the eyes of and should be in the eyes of other human beings. And also, so each utterly unique, each radically precious, and each unnegotiably equal. Right? Those are sort of the three things that derive from this Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The Mishnah will be familiar to some of you, I think, and we'll just move through it quickly. The context is talking about witnesses in a capital case. And the Mishnah is saying, how do we impress upon witnesses in a capital case where someone's life is at stake? If they're found guilty, they may be subject to the death penalty. How do we impress upon them the weight of their responsibility of having another human being's life in their hands? Right? That's the context of this mission. And so it says, we bring them in and press them. We're in the middle of the second page here. Perhaps what you say, we say to the witnesses, perhaps what you're saying isn't eyewitness testimony, but your own assessment or from rumors. Know that capital cases are not like monetary ones. In monetary cases, a false witness can return the money and achieve atonement. But in capital cases, the blood of the victim and all his future offspring hang upon you until the end of time. Okay, this is a very stark expression of the radical value
value of every human life. That's the context here. Again, addressing witnesses to say, you had better be sure that what you are testifying here in this court case is something that you are speaking to from your own eyewitness testimony. You better be careful with that, because if it's about, you know, there's a human life at stake here. And then it goes on, what is it based, what proof text does it bring in? Thus we find in regard to Cain, who killed his brother, right, this is referring to the story of Cain and Abel, and the Hebrew, right, the Hebrew from Bereshit says, Demei achicha tzoakim, the bloods of your brother cry out. Okay? So what the Mishnah is picking up on here is the fact that in the Hebrew it doesn't say, and it's a little bit playing with the grammar, but the Hebrew doesn't say the blood of your brother is crying out. It doesn't say dam achicha. So, right, the blood of your brother cries out. It says, "Demei achicha," the bloods of your brother cry out. So it's paying close attention to that aspect of the Hebrew grammar, and this is how it explains it. The verse does not say blood of your brother, but bloods of your brother, because it was his blood and also the blood of his future offspring screaming out, crying out. Okay, so in other words, the Mishnah is saying, when you kill a human being, you're not just killing that human being. When you take responsibility for the life of another human being, you're not just responsible for their life. You are responsible for all the lives that would have flown from that life if they had continued to live. Right? So this is, this is all in the, I love the context here, being helping witnesses understand the weight of their words in a capital case. It's just, so there's such gravity to it. And then it goes on to say it was for this reason that man was first created as one person, Adam. And this is, you know, often quoted, but it's often quoted not in the whole context. To teach you that anyone who destroys a life is considered by Scripture to have destroyed an entire world. And anyone who saves a life is as if he saved an entire world. Right, so here, that's not just a poetic flourish, right? To say, you know, a person's life is like a whole world. It's not just that. It's saying, think about all the ripples. Think about all the life that would have come from this life, and all of that is lost when you take a human being's life. And then it goes on to say, why else were we all created from one Adam, one human being, one first human being? To promote peace among the creations, so that no person would say to his friend, my ancestors are greater than yours, right? That hasn't worked so well. But the idea here is we can all point back to the same ancestor. So there you get that sense of radical equality. And then also so that heretics will not say there are many rulers up in heaven, right? That we all come from different sources, so maybe somehow we all come from different gods, we come from different rulers in heaven. But there's one creator in heaven who creates one human being from whom all the diversity of human life flows. And also to express the grandeur of the Holy Blessed One. And now I really want to make sure, I want to put a dagesh, I want to put an emphasis on this last part, because it goes back to the theme of ordinary and extraordinary. For a human being strikes many coins from the same die, and all the coins are alike. Right? That's how it works
in human existence, when you use a mold to cast coins, they all come out exactly alike. But the King of Kings, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, Melech Machem Machim, strikes every human being from the die of the first human being, and yet no person is quite like his friend. Therefore, every person must say, for my sake, the world was created. Right? So this is really a paradigm for understanding what it means to be a human being. Is that every single, we all come from a common source. We are all utterly precious and totally equal, and no two people are alike. We're each ordinary in our extraordinariness. Right? It's a very powerful conception of the self, of what it means to be a self in relationship to other human beings. Okay. Now it's going to get a little more complicated. Any questions about that passage thus far? Questions or any protests against it? Anybody think I'm not reading it fairly? Anybody read it really differently? Okay.
Well, yes, actually.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Thank you for providing. I'm Bruce. I'm from Belmont.
Sure.
Thank you for providing the context.
Yeah.
Because the context makes me think that some lives perhaps are more precious than others, in the sense that I'm a little older. I dare say I could impregnate somebody, but my childbearing days are over.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be creating any more new worlds.
Mm.
Got it?
Mm.
And there are people who are on the verge of creating new worlds.
Mm.
And isn't their life, therefore, a little bit more superior to mine?
Mm.
So thank you for plunging me into the context, which has to do with that, but it may be pulling me away from the main message.
Mm-hmm.
I admit it's there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, have you reconciled that yourself?
It's fascinating. It's a very rabbinic move you're making. No, really, to say, oh, so.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's obvious.
Right. I mean, I don't think that is where this Mishnah is trying to take us. But I hear what you're saying. I don't. I really do. It's
Following up.
That's good.
Every parent. You know, my name is Ron. I live in Boston.
Yeah.
Every parent would sacrifice their own life to save the life of their child or children.
Yeah.
Okay. Therefore, the parent feels that their life, that their children's lives, are more important or more superior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I what I would say to both of these comments, I guess, is that I think there are 1,000 ways, actually, on the human plane, that we make distinctions between the value of different lives. And I think that this Mishnah is trying to point us to a certain kind of God's eye view, which does not make those differentiations, that says, you know, yes, you may, that may be what it means to live in human society, is you're going to, in all kinds of different ways, say, in this context, one life matters more than another. And maybe we even have to say that, but maybe this is also asking us to hold on to another perspective, which says, it's all utterly precious. And no two human beings, the fact that no two human beings are alike is very critical to this view. Yeah?
John Gorenberg from Brookline. I interpreted it a little differently from that gentleman. I interpreted it as God wanted a world to have the many facets represented by each individual, and if you take a life, you destroy the world that God wanted to create. And it's less about progeny and that, that it's from a higher perspective. The world that would have been if that facet had remained in it and all that could flow from that.
putting an emphasis on something that's certainly important to me in the way that I'm reading this and in relation to the other texts we're going to look at, which is that this view really challenges us, not just to say human life is sacred, but to say the differences between us, that there are things that you embody, and we'll see, it's gonna have to do with how we read Torah, it's gonna have to do with so much, but there are unique qualities or a unique essence to you that you embody that the world would be impoverished without.
It's a wonderful life, right?
That and that I could, if we could never, it would just, the world would be without that. Okay, just a couple more comments.
Jay, Sharon. So I certainly agree that each human life is unique, but equal and extraordinary, I'm having trouble with. For example, somebody who discovers some sort of cure for disease and saves many, many lives, that person seems to have done more. So.
I agree. Well, this is, I think, exactly, at the crux of the issue. It's impossible for us as human beings not to make those value judgments, right? And we know that they quickly get very, very dangerous. When we measure the worth of a life in terms of achievement, or extraordinariness of achievement, right? So again, I think the perspective here, can you hold on to that perspective and also imagine there's a God's eye view which says, this person over here who you think really is a schlepper is actually embodying some unique aspect of creation without which the world would be impoverished. I think that's what it's asking us.
Mari Rabinovitz, Brookline. I was just concerned with who sets the value of human life. Who's to judge? Is the CEO of a corporation more valuable in what sense than, let's say, the cleaning person who
mm-hmm.
cleans the offices?
Yeah.
But who are we to say that?
Are we basing it
human life on accomplishments,
right,
which may not be the way the Mishnah is saying that?
Right. Beautiful, yeah. There's a wonderful midrash that I love just from this last week's parsha that speaks to this. It's just another angle on it, where it's the moment where the people are standing at the sea and Pharaoh's army's behind them. And they're terrified, and they're fetching, of course, and mm-hmm. saying, "Did you take us out into the wilderness to die?" And Moses says, "Have no fear. God will be here for you. God will deliver you." And God in the parsha, God says, "Matitzak elai. What are you crying out to me for?" So it's a really funny moment. What has Moses done wrong here exactly? And there's a midrash from Bereishit Rabbah that says that what Moses did wrong is that he didn't understand that God is Shomea Tfilah. God hears the prayers of every human being equally, all at the same time. And the people had already cried out. And so Moses, in this moment when he's crying out, is implying that God needs to hear from him in order to hear the people. And the Midrash goes on to say, for human beings, it's virtually impossible to hear a wealthy person standing in front of you the same way you hear a poor person standing in front of you. That we're not capable of hearing them in the same way, and God is not like that, the Midrash says. Lokach, that God has this capacity to hear and, I would say, receive and see all of us in this radically equal light. So there's a real
I think if I go back to the first example of Cain and Hevel with Dmei Achicha, Dmei Achicha later on can read it as money. You know, money. So that Dmei became Dmei Kadima, Dmei things, that's really money. That money can save that life and can destroy that life.
Yes, you're right. There are midrashim that go in that direction as well, that pick up on that double meaning of the word Dmei. Absolutely. Okay, so let's forge on. Again, the sources got a little smushed here, but right below the Mishnah from Sanhedrin, there's a verse from Ezekiel. Just one verse, 29:3, which is a verse attributed to Pharaoh in the book of Ezekiel. So Pharaoh is quoted in the book of Ezekiel as saying this unbelievable line to me. Li ye'ori va'ani asitini. My Nile is mine and I made it for myself. Right? If you can... We're on the same wavelength. Anyway... If you can hear in the Hebrew, li ye'ori va'ani asitini, that E sound in Hebrew is the possessive I, and you can hear it in every single word in the sentence, right? This is really sort of the grammar of narcissism, right? And it's put in the mouth of Pharaoh. What Pharaoh is embodying is a view of reality that I would argue is antithetical to the view put forth in the Mishnah, which sees himself as he's utterly self-sufficient here, and there is no room for anyone else to have a meaningful place in this universe, right? My Nile is mine, and I made it for myself. We did have a comment. I don't want to get too political. But Connie just as soon as I read it, she just muttered the word Trump. And I have to admit that this verse, which I heard many years ago, but it has been, like, haunting me since November 2016. And here I would say, just to, you know, really in all seriousness, not be overly political, I think that aspect of what we are witnessing all over the place in leadership in this country is just holding up a mirror back to something that is such a deep part of our culture. That's my opinion. I want to contrast, we're going to skip the next source in the interest of time, but I want to go to the next page, to Exodus Rabbah 2:6. And I want to contrast that statement of Pharaoh's, that view of the universe, of the world, with this stunning little midrash from Shemot Rabbah, from Exodus Rabbah, which is on the encounter between Moses and God at the burning bush. So the midrash, you know that part of the midrashic move is to make a tzimis out of everything, because no letter, no punctuation, no word certainly is extraneous in Torah. That's sort of our assumption in reading Torah, is that there is meaning to be found in every detail, every grammatical detail, every word, every letter, every jot and tittle. So I partly love this midrash because it's a punctuation midrash. And, you know, as somebody who cares about punctuation, the good old days when punctuation mattered. So it's picking up on the opening at the bush when it says, Vayomer Moshe, Moshe. Right, that God calls out to Moses from the bush, GMOs as influences. The problem that this midrash has, the problem that the midrash is responding to, is that every other place that you have that God calling out with a double name, every other place in Tanakh, there's a little vertical line, literally a punctuation mark, a little vertical line called a pasek that appears between the two repetitions of the name. Right? So when God calls out Abraham, Abraham, in the Akedah, there's a pasek, there's a little vertical line. When God calls out Yaakov, Yaakov, there's a little vertical line. Shmuel, Shmuel. The Midrash gives a bunch of examples, and it says, why is there no little vertical line between Moses and Moses when God calls out and says, Moshe, Moshe? Right? That's the premise of the Midrash. Right here, the Hebrew text provides no stop equivalent to a comma between the two occurrences of the name Moses. Why not? This question may be answered by the parable of a man overloaded by an excessively heavy burden who cries out all in one breath, somebody, somebody, come quickly and take this load off. So what is going on here? What's the Midrash saying or implying?
Impatience. Jeff, impatience.
Impatience.
Get over here or else.
You know. Impatience on whose part?
The person with the load.
Yeah, who's the person with
the
load?
God.
God,
God.
Yeah. Right?
He says, Moshe, Moshe.
God is, right, so God is breathlessly saying, Moshe, Moshe, quick, quick, help me. Lift the... So you're emphasizing the impatience in this.
Right.
What else is striking about this?
I think it's happiness. Is so. Yes, yes, come on, quick, quick,
come. Okay. Yeah. Is this a... Yeah. Yes.
Seems like need. Yeah. Need help. God needs Moses, which is interesting.
It sounds an awful lot like need, right? This is... God is being imagined as a person carrying a heavy load. The heavy load is the suffering of the people, of the slaves in Egypt. God is being imagined as a person carrying such a heavy load and so in need of help that he doesn't have time to pause for a passe. Moshe, Moshe. Right? This is not... First of all, it's not a kind of classical, omnipotent, you know, all-powerful image of God. This is a God who needs the partnership. He needs help. Who needs the partnership of human beings, needs the partnership of Moses to take the people out of Egypt. And I also think it's a stunning contrast to the Pharaoh of, you know, my Nile is mine and I created it. Right? Pharaoh, who believes he's God, has a very different image of what it means to be God or a human being, right? And God here, kivyachol, as it were, seems to be at least, if nothing, we can argue about whether the Midrash is really saying, actually, God needs our help. I think it is. But even if you don't go that far, it's certainly saying that God is modeling for Moses what it means to be a leader who needs help. Right? Hold on, I just want to give other people a chance also. Yeah?
Could it also be emphasizing, re-emphasizing that everybody has a role? It's not I need your help, but you can't just rely on God. Every human being has a role. This is yours.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can extend that for everybody in the world, right? It's
right.
Just, you are responsible for your life and the life of others.
Right, right. Nice. So it's sort of underscoring for Moses that sense of, again, you know, going back to the mission, but everybody has their role to play. This is yours, and God is making room for that. It's sort of an act of, it seems sort of an act. act of divine contraction in order to make.
Otherwise, the individuals are less meaningful, right?
Mm-hmm.
God does everything.
Nice. I love that. And I don't want to totally take away the urgency of the, you know, it feels like more than just a pedagogic move in the language of the Midrash, but I think it's a really beautiful way of understanding what's happening here. Yeah.
God may not be calling to Moses for help, but more for Moses to act as his facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
I need a human being down there to organize the whole Exodus.
I love that also. Again, I there's a vulnerability to the language and to the image here of a person weighed down by a burden that I think is very evocative, that I think the Midrash is asking us to sort of hold that. But yes, absolutely, to this sense of divine human partnership that's going to be so important, this liberation is going to happen.
Thank everyone for what you said, because you're following in a path that I think we've heard a lot of and that I think goes against the first Midrash. All of us who've been here have heard an awful lot about and how many books are written on Jewish leadership.
Mm.
There isn't much on Jewish fellowship, is there?
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the hierarchy. There's God, and then there's Moses. Is there any model, I haven't turned all the pages here, but is there a paradigm for the lowest down on the list, so to speak?
Mm.
Otherwise, we're reverting back to something that not everybody is as worthy in the creation of the world as everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
We have this leadership thing in our heads, and we can't get rid of it. Now
right.
I see it.
I hear you. I think we're again, it's interesting. We're going to keep wrestling with this. But aren't some people more extraordinary, you know? And I don't think any of this has to contradict that basic intuition, which is hard for us to get away from. But so I don't think it means that there aren't that people in this model, people do have different roles. Right? And some people may be destined to leadership and some people may be destined to followership, and within that there's, you know, countless capacities that are called upon. But I think you're pushing that maybe a step further than I want to go or than I think the Mishnah is going, which is to say that is reflecting sort of an ontological truth about people's worth, right? That in other words, you're saying the fact that some people are extraordinary and meant to be leaders and other people are meant to be followers means that in the eyes of God, aren't those leaders, aren't their lives worth more? And I think the Mishnah would say, no. I think that's where the rub is. But we're not gonna resolve this. Take a couple more comments on this, and then keep moving. Debbie, since we haven't heard from you, Amanda.
I'm Debbie. Yeah. I was just going to sort of echo that I was thinking we went from this idea of all of us are unique and equal and precious to God speaking to Moses, meaning sort of how is that not an elevated stance or seeing that as more special among all of us who are so special.
Right.
So it's hard to reconcile.
Right. Except that if God is modeling what it means for God to need Moses, then what does that imply about who Moses is going to need? Right? And the fact that Moses, if Moses is going to be a leader acting in God's image, then maybe he needs to understand, and we're going to get to it in this week's Parsha, you know, maybe he needs to understand that he is not omnipotent and he's not self-sufficient and he is going to need what every member of the people has to bring, the gifts that every member of the people has to bring. Maybe, just saying. Okay. Yes, last comment.
I think we're mixing up two concepts here. One is, are all people created equal in capability and what they can do? And that's one issue. But the other issue is how those people feel about themselves, which I think is more important. It gets back to the original concept we were talking about. I think that people can be very proud of being who they are, even though they're not the CEO. Maybe they are the cleaner.
Right.
And I think that that's a really important difference here. I don't think anybody's going to argue that people are created differently. The IQ test proves that. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I love that, and I question how easy it is for people to ignore all the cultural messages that tell them what they're worth and not worth relative to other people, and access that sense of worth that you're talking about.
I've seen many people in lower levels who are very proud of the work they do.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love that, and I think this is giving expression. It's sort of a theological way of thinking about that, right? Not just being proud of the work you do, which is that's important, but also knowing that one has fundamental human worth, whatever work you do or don't do, right? Can we access that? It's very hard. I think it's very hard for us as human beings to access that, I think. Or at least there's a lot that, you know, we're buffeted by that cuts against that. Okay, let's keep going. Very quickly, I don't want to dwell on this one, but just since it's in this week's Parsha and it's very much related to the thread of the conversation about leadership, right? These are the verses at the bottom of this page from this week's Parsha where Moses' father-in-law, Yitro, says to Moses, he sees Moses sitting among the people, and Moses is basically adjudicating cases from morning till night, right? And Yitro says, what is this thing you're doing to the people? Why do you act alone while all the people stand about you from morning till evening? And Moses basically says, they need me, I have to do this. And Yitro says, the thing you're doing is not right. You will surely wear yourself out, and these people as well, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Right? So I want to ask us to hear that verse in light of the Midrash, sort of having that Midrash about God feeling like the load is too heavy for God to bear alone. Hear the echoes between those two, right? Moses, right? Yitro is
not for
trying to help teach Moses what I think God was also trying to teach Moses at the bush, which is that none of us work alone. None of us can do this alone.
No man is an island.
I need you. No man is an island. Yeah.
Everybody works together.
Absolutely. Okay, so we're going to jump to the bottom of the next page, the source that says Psikta Derav Kahana, because I want to look together at a couple of sources that, to me, have to do with how does this worldview, how does this view of the radical uniqueness and value of every human life come into play in terms of our ability to understand and receive Torah in all its fullness. So I want to look at this midrash briefly from Sikta de Rav Kahana, and then at another beautiful commentary on what it means to study Torah in the Beit Midrash. A little louder? Yeah. So this first one from Sikta de Rav Kahana is talking about the revelation of Torah at Sinai. And it says, commenting on the verse, I am the Lord your God. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina said, God's speech at Sinai, the revelation of Torah, came to each individual according to their capacity. Do not be surprised at this. When the manna descended for Israel, each person tasted it according to their own capacity. Infants tasted it according to their capacity, the young according to theirs, the elders according to theirs. In the same way as the manna tasted in each person's mouth according to their capacity, so each individual heard God's speech according to their capacity. Right, so it's a remarkable vision of revelation of Torah at Sinai, which is that God's word somehow, God's revelation comes forth, and it is received differently by every human being standing there, because every human being has different capacities, right? I mean, here it's playing with age, but it goes on and plays with other things, so that there's no two people receive Torah in exactly the same way. Okay, this is sort of the image of revelation at Sinai. I always have to allow for the protest voices before we move on. So that's a fairly commonly quoted midrash, and it's a pretty widely found in the midrash, that view of revelation, which
just
says,
"Yeah." Did everyone hear the same words and interpret it differently, or did each one hear different words?
If a tree falls in the forest, it feels like a related question. Don't know. I mean, there are midrashim that even say, your question makes me think of a wonderful midrash that says that the only word, not even word, the only letter spoken at Sinai was the first aleph of Anochi, the first aleph of the first verse, right? What does an aleph sound like?
It doesn't
breath.
Say it.
A breath. Right, a breath.
It doesn't
yeah.
Say it.
Sorry?
It doesn't say Ehe Asher Ehe.
That's at the snap.
That's not what he said, that's not his question?
No, that's a different, yeah. The Ehye Asher Ehye, I will be what I will be, is what God says, is the name that, when Moses says, tell me your name, or what shall I tell people is your name, God says, Ehye Asher Ehye. So he's asking at the Sinai, not at the Sneh, but at Mount Sinai, is this Midrash and others, are they suggesting that people heard different words, or they heard the same words but interpreted them in different ways? And I'm just saying, there's a lot of, it gets very, you know, the Midrash gets very creative with what actually happened at Sinai. But the sense that we can't quite grasp, you know, there is some kind of moment of revelation that the people are sharing as a people and yet receiving in very different ways, depending on their unique capacities. Okay, so now I want to take us into, this is just a commentary that I love from the Vilna Gaon, And we're not going to go through the whole thing, but if you go, all right, so let me just give a little bit of context. In Pirkei Avot, in the 10th chapter of Pirkei Avot, there's a whole section which is quoted here. We're not going to go through all of it, but it says, HaTorah Niknet. Torah is acquired by means of 48 attributes or 48 qualities. Okay, and then it goes on, in Pirkei Avot, it goes on to give a long list of all the qualities that are needed in order to receive Torah. So again, you have this, you know, issue of different human capacities being required to receive Torah. And the list, you know, it's very interesting to go through the list sometime. We're not going to do it now, but it's worth going through and asking yourself, like, okay, how am I doing on this one? How am I doing on this? But by study, by attentiveness, by orderly speech, by an understanding heart, is a really interesting list of 48 qualities that are needed to receive Torah, to acquire Torah. And I don't know about other people, but by the time you get to the end of reading the list, you know, you're feeling like, oh, well. I'm like, no way.
I tried.
So the Vilna Gaon brings a really interesting comment on this in the context. He's using gematria, but we can stay and talk about it afterwards for anyone who's interested. But he's commenting on, actually, a verse from Eshet Chayil, from The Woman of Valor. Rabot banot asu chayil, right? Many daughters have done chayil, have been valorous, but you surpassed them all. And here's the clay that the Vilna Gaon does. He says, this is at the bottom of the next page, people see where we are. The Torah is acquired by means of 48 attributes, and whoever has more of these attributes is able to acquire more Torah. There you go. There's your extraordinariness, right? And, you know, so the rest of us are feeling a little badly about ourselves, whatever. Okay. But, he says, it is impossible, not only unlikely, it's impossible for any one person to have all 48 attributes. Rather, one person has some, a second person has others, so that only with everyone together will all of the attributes be made manifest. And by the way, by implication, only with everyone together will Torah be fully revealed. Okay. And the entirety of Torah can only be acquired with all 48 attributes. Right, he does say that expressly. And then he's doing a little gematria with the phrase rabot banot. But so I'm going to actually just, in the interest of time, I'm going to paraphrase, but I promise I'm doing it. I'm not doing anything fast, and let's see, this is what he says. So he says that this is really a way of understanding chevruta study. This is a way of understanding why we study with partners in the Beit Midrash, why the classical Jewish mode of Torah study is with partners, because if you can't understand and receive the fullness of Torah without all of these attributes, and no one person has all of these attributes, then you've got to study it together. You need a partner to bring out the Torah that you can't understand yourself because of your own limited capacities. And valuable capacity, you know, you've also got to, okay, so... So a student of the Vilna Gaon, if you flip to the top of the next page, makes it really explicit. It says, according to the Vilna Gaon, it is impossible to reach the fullness of Torah without all 48 attributes, and because it's impossible for one person to have all 48 attributes, and each person must complete the missing attributes of his friend, and vice versa, it's obvious that when there is division among study companions, they cannot complement each other and attain all 48 attributes together. This is possible only when study companions love one another. And so one could argue, so this is funny, he now right? The Vilna Gaon is saying all these attributes are necessary. No one person has all of them. And then Rav Tatler can't resist saying, but there's one attribute that's really more important than all the rest. It's that human impulse. Yeah, there's one extraordinary attribute. And he says, that one is being ohev habriyot. That one is loving all creatures. That's the most important because...
Not in America.
Not in America. Because if you're not ohev habriyot, if you understand what he's saying, if you're not able to love all creatures, then you're not going to be able to learn the Torah that your chavruta partner or that another person in the room has to bring. Right? And so he goes on to say, actually, loving all creatures is the glue that holds all of them together. Because we need that capacity to actually love other people in order to receive the Torah that they have uniquely received according to their capacity.
Connie, I think also loving someone means listening. Mm-hmm. Because that's in the chavruta what you do. You have to do it.
So deeply together. Shema, you know.
It's a chavruta, to me sometimes it looks so difficult, so different ideas. If you go on and see Betty Ben Shalom, they're so big, different, they can like, sit down together and talk about the same idea. Everybody can be more like
the big one. Right. Well, yeah, you know, it's. Are people familiar? There's a great sort of scene in the Gemara where a student comes into a Beit Midrash and everybody is arguing with each other about, you know, what's pure and what's impure and when. And the student says, how am I supposed to figure out what's true if everybody, you know, if everybody's arguing with each other? And the Rav answering, the answer that comes to him is, build another chamber in your heart and make room for all of them, all of these. Because they're all words of the living God. I love that image of like somehow expand. It's about expanding the capacity of the heart to listen. Yeah.
Could you speak for a moment about the reference to trust in the sages? Is that kind of navigating the intermediated, disintermediated, you know, fault line that's been part of our discussion here?
Mm. You mean the in the list of the 48? Yeah. Well, gosh, I mean, we can go through each one is really complex. How do I mean, basically.
That's reference to trusting what somebody else says is
right.
Correct
right.
In some fashion. As the others, at least the ones I've noticed,
yeah.
You could do on your own in a way.
Right,
you know,
right.
Sort of they didn't require a mediated.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting, right. I mean, you can't do them on your own because nobody has all of them.
Right, right.
But that one directly requires, yeah. I mean, I think the classical understanding of what that attribute is about is actually deference to a teacher, you know, deference to the sage. It has to do with sort of a kind of humility and deference to authority.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of love the reading that you're adding in.
Doesn't it say somewhere, sit at the feet of the masters?
It does. But it says somewhere else, don't trust the rabbinic authority.
It wouldn't be saying we need followers too, and that's a blessing, right? When he was asking, isn't that saying we need followers?
That's wonderful.
There's
yes.
A time to be a good follower.
Absolutely.
Not all the time, but sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, on leaders and followers, my personal bias, I don't have a proof text off the top of my head, but my personal bias is that many of us, if not most of us, are leaders and followers in different ways, in different contexts, in different times in our lives. You know, nobody is, well, most people aren't leaders all the time or followers all the time. But yes, I had a good friend who did his dissertation at Yale in followership.
Oh,
He was obsessed with the same thing. He was like, enough with all this leadership stuff. Somebody's got to study followership. But I think it fits, right?
Yeah.
That you know, somebody has special capacities. There are real capacities involved in being a good follower. Yeah. Yeah, I could go off on that tangent. But
Are you going to have time to make that connection you started with of narcissism and loneliness? Because I find that a fascinating idea. And we only got a few minutes left in the talk.
Yes.
You didn't leave time for your punchline.
Okay.
It's never enough.
I'll do that now. You have to take the rest of the sources as a party favor to take home. They are especially if you have time, I want to encourage you to look at the Yismach Yisrael on Rosh Chodesh Adar. This is a Hasidic master teaching about the beginning of the month of Adar.
Yes.
And he's asking the question of how do we enter the gates of joy in Adar? And he says we do it by loving our friends and by uniting with other people. And the part of the basis for how he comes to that is he talks about the deep Torah of Shabbat Shkalim, right, the Shabbat that comes before Purim, and the fact that we're asked to bring a half shekel. Each person in the community is asked to bring a half shekel. And he says the reason for that, the Torah behind the half shekel, is to teach us this idea that each of us is only able to bring a part. Because each of us is only a part. And we need everybody else to bring their part. Right? And so that's, for him, the source of joy in Adar. It actually connects to the loneliness and narcissism thing. For me. So I'll respond to the question by way of the title of the what I called the session. So I called the session Sameach Bechelko, rejoicing in being a part.
Rejoicing what?
In being a part.
A part.
Okay? And you might recognize the words. It shows up in Pirkei Avot, actually. Ezehu Asher, who's content, hasameach bechelko, the one who is able to rejoice in his or her portion. And it shows up also in Shabbat Shacharit, right? Yismach Moshe b'matnat chelko. Moshe rejoiced in the giving of his portion. So what the reason that I'm now translating that as rejoicing in being a part is that a lot of this Torah, which has been important to me for a long time, about understanding that we're only a part of a larger whole and that none of us is self-sufficient, none of us is enough, we need each other, no man is an island, all of that, there's a lot of humility in that, and that's very important. But it's actually not just about a kind of miserable awareness of, I'm limited, I don't have the whole picture, I certainly don't have those 48 attributes, you know. It is about humility, but it's not only, it doesn't stop at that sense of limitation. Because what the Pirkei Avot and the liturgy points to by connecting it to simcha, to joy, is saying actually there's also a deep joy in that humility of recognizing that we only have a part and we only are a part of a larger picture. Because in that context, we're not self-sufficient and we're not alone. Right?
If we're apart, then we're not alone.
Yeah. So actually that the longing to feel like we are enough in and of ourselves, ironically, paradoxically, pulls us away from the joy of belonging to something larger. and not only the humility and vulnerability of needing other people, but the joy of meeting other people and being in relationship to other people.
Yes. It also removes the responsibility, because if we're part of something bigger, then we don't have to worry about being perfect and taking care of everything. The larger whole that's really responsible for making the world a better place.
Yeah. You're responsible for your peace.
Yeah.
You are very responsible. Yeah. But you're not responsible for the whole. That's a kind of grandiosity that we're asking.
That's part of the narcissistic grandiosity.
Exactly. So thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thinking about next time, we have our next session in February, on February 27th, right here, and it will be with Rabbi David Jaffe, who will be talking about an inside-out path to health using Musar, wisdom to create a life of balance and wellness. So another interesting topic. I hope you'll all join us. If you don't have one of these, they're right over there. It gives you the times, the dates of when, or the time's always the same, but when, who's going to be here and what the topic's going to be. I know we've had some trouble with reminder emails. So we sent out an email that reminded you, hopefully, for the next three this past week on Thursday. Can you raise your hand if you did not receive this email? So what I'm going to have you do, if you don't mind, is I'm going to have you, there's a piece of paper over there. Would you please, I know you've done this probably a bunch of times, but we're really trying to get this right, and for some reason it's not quite working yet. Would you please write your email as legibly as you possibly can down on that sheet of paper that says email, so that we can make sure to get you the reminders. People did receive the reminder for the next three, though. Some people did, right?
I'm
not sure. No, I didn't, because last time they said.
All right, so we are working on it. We're getting better. And again, have a wonderful rest of your January, and I will see you next month.
And I think that was the point you were making by saying yourself about mental bills, piles, gaps. Where I was a little confused, a burden of things that just
went to my head. So the way I understand it is that I've been talking about all of this in terms of our relationship to others.
Right.
I saw it as a poet, so extending it as a bird, a tree, everything. We're part of this whole
tapestry. The bird as well.
Thank you.
I'd love to find out about the followers.
I'm very I gotta put my name down because I didn't get the email.
That would be great. I've got a funny vignette for you on the Leader for Persons Scholarship. A long time ago, I read a story about someone who rose from very low in their hierarchy to very high. And she said, all it took was every time something came up, she said, I can do good, I'll put it here. So it speaks to both, right? That's followership. She didn't pray, but it was integral to success.
Have you written about this concept of connecting narcissism and loneliness? Or is somebody else?
I have a
I have a drush I've written about it. If you want to give me your email.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because I find myself in both camps there.
Yeah.
And,
let me go to the lid.
Usually I'm like,
they, yeah,
you know, I'm always impressed with Western people. Dads have done
kind of things.